right, here we go. All right, matey, you ready?
I am now, yeah.
Okay, I'll do a little preamble, okay, and then I'll bring you in, love, all right? Okay, here we go. Okay, here we go. Hello, my darlings, and welcome to COVID Island. A bit like Desert Island Discs, we invite our guests to go off to the island to intrepidly self-isolate with 8 radio dramas of their choice. We do give them 1 piece of music to take with them, and we also ask them for a memory from lockdown to take with them to the island. I am Clive Perrott, theatrical agent, an actor. I was an actor. And about 30 years ago, or was it longer? I don't know. I was doing a tour. It was my first job, and it was a sex farce. It wasn't very sexy, and it certainly wasn't very funny. It was ghastly. It was dreadful. But the one wonderful redeeming thing about the whole thing was my fellow actor. And my fellow actor, he was young and sprightly then, was today's guest, Jonathan Keeble. Now, while we were touring up and down the country in this awful show, we used to listen to Peter Cook and Dudley Moore. And there was a character called Alf. Alfie Noakes. Alfie Noakes was an organ comic. Alf knows jokes, folks. And Jonathan became Alf to me, and I became Alf to Jonathan. I've never called Jonathan Jonathan. He is Alf, Alfie Noakes. Well, who is Jonathan Keeble? Who is Alfie Noakes? He's recorded over 800 BBC radio plays. And on top of that, he's recorded over 700 audio books. He's got one of the most wonderful, seductive voices you'd ever hear. And you're going to hear it now because I'm going to bring him on. Jonathan, Alf.
How are you?
Very well. I'm humbled to be able to interview you today, my dear fellow. Humbled. Jonathan, Alf, before we get into some of your lovely choices today, your 8 radio dramas, how did you end up in the, you're an actor, of course, but why radio? Why the realm of audio? Tell me how that happened.
Well, I think my first epiphany of acting was listening to Richard Burton doing Under Milk Wood when I was about 10, living in Devon. And I was quite an odd child, a bit of an outsider. And I was given this record of Under Milk Wood. And I just fell in love with the way the man used the English language and made words come alive. The story, I learned it off by heart, more or less. Then I did the usual thing. I went to drama school, became an actor, and eventually, I never forgot about the radio, and I wrote to the BBC asking for an audition, and eventually I got one, got on the BBC Radio Drama Company, and that's how it all started. When we worked together, I hadn't done radio, but that has now dominated, it has to be said. I've done quite a lot of theatre, but the radio and the audio world have become a big part of my life, and it's a part of my life that I really love.
So you've mentioned Under Milk Wood, and that's your first choice. Shall we hear a little bit?
Yeah.
To begin at the beginning. It is spring, moonless night in the small town, starless and Bible black, the cobble streets silent and the hunched quarters and rabbits wood limping invisible down to the slow black, crow black fishing boat bobbing sea. The houses are blind as moles, though moles see fine tonight in the snouting velvet dingles, or blind as Captain Cat there in the muffled middle by the pump and the town clock, the shops in mourning, the welfare hall in widow's weeds, and all the people of the lulled and dumbfound town are sleeping now. Hush! The babies are sleeping, the farmers, the fishers, the tradesmen and pensioners, cobbler, schoolteacher, postman and publican, the undertaker and the fancy woman, drunkard, dressmaker, preacher, policeman, the webfoot cockle women, and the tidy wives. Young girls lie bedded soft or glide in their dreams with rings and trousseaus, brides made by glowworms down the aisles of the organ-playing wood. The boys are dreaming wicked, or of the bucking ranches of the night and the jolly rogered sea. And the anthracite statues of the horses sleep in the fields, and the cows in the byres, and the dogs in the wet-nosed yards, and the cats nap in the slant corners, or lope, sly, streaking and needling on the one cloud of the roofs.
Absolutely wonderful. Actually, didn't you go and visit Richard Burton's birthplace?
Yeah, I'd always wanted to go to Pontre de Venne, which is where Burton was born, just near Port Talbot, a few miles away. So I drove down there, and it was New Year. And I went to see the house where he was born, and there was a blue plaque on the wall. And then I went up to the pub, the Miner's Arms, where he used to drink when he came home. And it was New Year. A little old lady was coming down the road. As I walked up, I said, Happy New Year. And she said, well, you're not from the village then, are you? And I said, no, I'm just visiting, paying homage to Richard Burton, and he's a hero of mine, and I'm a young actor. And it was his sister, Hilda. She still lived in the village, in a house that Burton had bought her. And she took me to the house and showed me pictures and various things. And then what I'm about to say is absolutely true. It gets very bizarre here because I came back at Easter to stay with her. She asked me to come down and meet the rest of the family who are coming at Easter. So I went down and I met Sis, his eldest sister, who was still alive then, and various members of the family. And I stayed in Hilda's house. But that night, as we're sitting there after the others had left, and I'm talking to Hilda and her husband, Di. Now, Di was this Welsh miner who had married Hilda before Richard Burton was Richard Burton, when he was still Richard Jenkins. Didn't know the sort of life he would have. And I'm sitting there with Hilda and she's getting albums out. And she gets this album out and she's showing me pictures of Elizabeth Taylor's 40th. And there was a big party in Monte Carlo. Everyone was there. Burton flew the family over, and there's little Di there, sitting there nodding, and she's showing me pictures, and she says, and this is Di dancing with Princess Grace, and this is Di doing, and I'm looking at this little man who knew his life had taken on a most bizarre turn. Anyway, we're drinking this lovely whiskey, and I said, this whiskey is amazing, what is it? And she said, oh, Liz sends a hamper every year from Fortnum and Mason's at Christmas. And this was the whiskey that was left over from the hamper. And jokingly, I said, well, you must thank her next time you speak to her, because they did keep in touch quite regularly. And she was a bit merry now. And she said, well, why don't you thank her yourself? She said, I'll phone her up. And she phoned Elizabeth Taylor in Palm Springs, where she was living at the time, and spoke to the secretary and said, yes, I've got Jonathan here. He's a great fan of Liz's. She's speaking to the secretary. Could you get her? I want him to have a word. So anyway, Liz Taylor comes on the phone, and then Hilda is handing me the phone, and it's Liz Taylor on the end of the line. So I said, oh, this is a great honour. She was very nice. She said, oh, I hear you're a big fan. What's your favourite film? And rather diplomatically, I said, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? Which, you know, it is one of my favourite Burton films. But she could remember lines from it. And I, at that time, you know, I was early 20s then, I sort of knew most of Burton's films off by heart. And we enacted certain scenes of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf over the telephone. So I'm in this little South Walian village, sitting with these two, you know, Welsh people, smiling benignly at me as I'm pretending to be Richard Burton on the phone to Elizabeth Taylor. So that's the story that connected with that.
Oh, that's a pretty damn good story. I mean, one of the many, many things that I'm jealous, it's the famous people you've hung out with. Your name dropping is you know, par excellence. It's wonderful. I remember one day you called me up. You knew that I was a rabid Doctor Who fan. And Alf, you said, what would be the worst thing in the world that could happen? And I said, well, I don't know. He said, no, you can. Go on, guess. And I was like, well, I don't know, Alf. What do you mean? Well, he said, what's the worst thing you could possibly imagine? And I thought for a moment, and I said, the worst thing I could imagine in my whole life is you being on Doctor Who and not me. And he said, that's it, Brit. And I said, what? And he said, I'm working with John Pertwee. Jonathan Alf did a radio play, Doctor Who play, with John Pertwee. I think it was the only one that John Pertwee did. And I was seething, and you took such delight in that. Yeah.
John Pertwee, it was the last Doctor Who he ever did. He died about a month afterwards. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was playing Elvis Presley on it. Of course. Anyway. But what happened was my brother was born with the umbilical cord wrapped around his neck, so he's mentally disabled. And he lived at the time with my parents down in Devon. He loved John Pertwee as Wurzel Gummidge. And it was one of my first radios, and you don't want to sort of impose, but I knew that for my brother, I had to do this. So I asked John if he wouldn't mind bringing in a photo, a signed photo to Jamie for my brother. And so he came in on the last day. Sure enough, he had his picture of Wurzel Gummidge to my dear friend Jamie, love, John. And I said, oh, that's going to mean so much to him, thank you. And he said, well, where does he live? And I said, he lives in Paignton, in Devon, with my mother. What's the number? And from the green room in Maida Vale at BBC, he phoned my mum up and got Jamie on the line, my brother, who had the mental age probably in single figures, and spoke to him as Wurzel. In the story, Wurzel Gummidge had been sold to a farmer in New Zealand. So he pretended he was phoning up from New Zealand, and he spoke to my brother for a good 10 minutes on this. And it was so beyond the call of duty. It was, I just have such fond memories of John Pertwee. He's, I think he was a really decent man. So that's what I took for, you know.
That's that story
right, so of that.
I've forgotten that. I do remember. Oh, what a lovely story. He was great. Right now, on the Doctor Who theme, in your next clip, we start with a little bit of Tom Baker, I think. This is from Bomber.
Tonight's operation to destroy the industrial centre of Krefeld has gone disastrously wrong. These returning airmen are totally unaware that due to a combination of bad luck and stronger-than-forecast winds, they have bombed and started a firestorm in the market town of Altgarten instead.
Well done, Commander. Good to see you back on
schedule.
In you go,
chaps. Come on inside now, inside.
Who are you waiting for, Corporal?
Oh, Orange. Any word, sir? Sergeant Lambert's aircraft.
I know you, don't I?
I'm Sam Lambert's wife.
He's what?
We were keeping it a secret, but it's all right, sir. The groupie knows now.
Oh.
Is there any word?
No, but keep your chin up, Corporal. Not too late. Excuse me.
In Altgarten, the last 2 hours have been a nightmare. It was impossible during the 23 minutes of the second wave attack to distinguish between individual explosions. 400 bombers each dropped an average of 12,000 pounds of high explosive bombs and incendiaries on the center of the town.
Ah, bomb to bugger it is enormous, Stack.
Everyone's been saying.
Debriefing hut at Whalley Fen. Flight Sergeant Carter and his crew, dirty-faced and red-eyed, light up and sip regulation tots of rum in mugs of hot cocoa.
There were plenty of fires to show away.
And what about the Greens?
So, Bomber was an amazing production in that they timed it with the actual operation. So the first play was on at something like 6:30 in the morning when the bomber took off. Then you had another play on at about 11 when it got over Germany. Then another one as it came back. And the thing that was really moving about it was intercut with reminiscences of the real people. I was thinking about this the other day, and I grew up, you know, we're the same sort of age, and I was born 21 years after the Second World War ended, and we grew up, and it was still quite current, all that. So I've always been fascinated in it. And I was thinking the other day that it sounds quite a long time ago, but if you think we're 2021 now, millennium was 2000, that's 21 years. So it really was quite current, the Second World War. And so this was like doing a film in that the radio studio was set up. So the plane was set up. So in the dead room, everyone was sitting at certain areas where the plane would have been. And the most amazing stories, these guys were, I mean, the actual people who were called upon to do it were generally very young. And after 20 missions, they were allowed to have a ground job. They were allowed to stop. But nearly all of them didn't, because they knew that they had the experience to maybe keep alive, whereas the average life expectancy was something like 3 missions. So if you survived 20, it meant you knew what you were doing. They didn't want to let the younger ones come in and be killed. And I met these guys at the Imperial Museum, and it was very moving. It was so epic, the whole thing. A real example of what radio can do for a fraction of the cost of doing it on film, of course.
It's funny, isn't it? Because our parents lived through through it, didn't they? They would have been kids, and they would have, you know, my parents were in London and they remember the bombing raids and so on. It's so close to us. And yet you and I both have kids, and I guess it's very distant for them. And this whole COVID thing, you must be doing the same thing, Alf, you know, where you go, COVID is awful and terrible and everybody's suffering, but it's not the First World War and it's not the Second World War.
Well, exactly. It's coming up for a year. And I was speaking to my younger lad today, who's 17 now, but I was saying to him, you can imagine how awful this has been for a year. The war was 5 years,
yeah,
where there was a curfew every night, where there was no, you know, rationing, where there was, for 5 years. It really does put these things into perspective. So it was a wonderful production, that, 1995, and an epic work. And
with a superb cast. Big names, big names.
Yeah, with Tom Baker. People like Frank Windsor in it, Jack Shepherd. In that clip, you heard Emma Chambers. Yeah, and so,
all right, so changing the subject, just as a little segue here. You were God once, weren't you? Were you God, is that right?
Yes, in the Sistine Chapel, yeah. One of the things that I do a lot of is audio guides for museums and things. And yeah, this one came in where I did a test. And anyway, I got the job and I went to the studio and they said, you might want to know this. And I said, what? The Sistine Chapel is the Pope's private chapel. So anything that happens in the Sistine Chapel connected to it has to be approved by the Pope, including the voice of God in the audio guide. So the producer of this thing was telling me that, you know, you can actually say that you now have papal
blessing, in
approval,
fact,
which I think absolved a lot of sins, Alf.
Oh, my goodness. You will go to heaven after all. Who'd have thought? All right, we're going to go into your next clip. So your next piece is As I Walked Out One Midsummer Morning. Do you want to take us into it? Tell us why. Why have you chosen that?
Well, I was brought up in the West Country, and, well, until I was, you know, 13 or 14, I had a real Devonian accent. My father, who was from London, thought that you can't be an actor, because I said I wanted to be an actor. You couldn't have an actor and have a West Country accent. So he used to sit me down in front of the news, and it was Kenneth Kendall in those days, and I had to repeat what Kenneth Kendall was saying as he said it, rather than the way I said it. So he'd come on and say, today in Uganda, President Idi Amin has stated that, and I go, today in Uganda, President Idi Amin has stated that, and he'd hit me, and then I'd have to repeat it. So he trained me out of my West Country accent. So this was a chance, playing Laurie Lee in As I Walked Out One Midsummer Morning, to use the West Country accent. But Laurie Lee is from Gloucestershire. I'm from Devon. They're very different accents. And it is the only time I've really done this, but I drove to Slad in Gloucestershire, where he's from, and sat in the local pub and listened to the locals to get the difference in the accents.
All right, well, let's have a listen, shall we? See how it panned out.
Stay here, Law. Stay here and marry me.
No, I can't. I'm going to London.
What do you want to go to London for? What's in London if you can't find here?
And as I've never seen the sea, I'll walk to the coast first and find it.
The Law.
Down through Wiltshire I go, burning my roots behind me, coming through Malmesbury and Chippenham, and already noting different shades of speech. I pass down the Wylie Valley and come out on a vast and rolling plain, which looks as though it's just been cropped by mammoths, and I'm unprepared for the delicate spire that rises suddenly out of the empty plain. Salisbury, on market day. The pubs are bursting with dealers counting money. Shepherds and dogs sit around on the pavements, and supreme above all towers the misty cathedral, still prince of the horizontal town, throwing its slow shifting shade across the market square. I arrive at Southampton where, after sleeping in fields for a week, I think I'll try a bed again in a doss house down by the docks.
Shilling a night, money in advance. One glass of whiskey thrown in. If you want more, it's threepence a top. Bucket of water there for your wash. What ship are you from?
I've come from Stroud.
Never heard on it. Foreign ship, like as not. Musical fella, though, eh? Hey, diddle diddle, I reckon. Plays the fiddle, do you? Yeah. Much money in it?
Well, I don't know. I'm about to find out.
Accents. Yeah, I mean, I've spent a lot of my life not speaking my own voice.
How do you do that? What do you cling on to? What do you listen? What's your hook?
It's usually rhythm.
Right.
It's usually rhythm with all accents, actually. The thing about accents is if you have an ear, often what you think is right is right. When I first joined the Radio Drama Company, one of the first jobs I had was with Celia Imrie in a sitcom written by a guy called Simon Brett. And I had to play her boyfriend, a Hungarian boyfriend. And I thought, well, Hungarian accent, what I want to really get it right. So I summoned up this record from the radio archive of a Hungarian composer being interviewed. And he sounded just like Bela Lugosi. The trouble is with accents, it's like, if you actually do it that strongly, people would think, oh, no, that's not right. But often it is. And it's even in period things. If you do a Coward play or something, or a newsreader from the 1940s. If you're doing a newsreader from the 1940s, I mean, they really do speak like that. But if you did it like that on the radio, people would think you're taking the mickey. So you have to sort of tone things down. Sometimes you're not actually being as truthful as you could be because people wouldn't think it's truthful. So it's quite interesting with accents. You have to be very careful. I mean, that one, as I walked out my summer morning, I did want to get right because the Devon accent was slightly different. Gloucestershire's more measured. Devon, they speak quite quick. So I wanted to get it right. And Gloucestershire is slightly more gentle than Devon.
Yes, I got that. I got the gentler, the smoothness of that accent. So here's something very different now. Let's go to your next choice. We're going to hear it first and then chat to us about it. This is The First Day of the Rest of My Life.
Hey, why don't we head back to mine for a bit of one-on-one customer service?
What about your friend?
Craig? Oh, he's gay.
Doesn't seem gay to me.
Yeah, well, he's in the closet. Doesn't know who he is. Let's forget about him.
Hey, come in. Come through. I'll take your coat. Come through.
So you don't live with your mum, then?
Divorced.
You do surprise me.
Well, her loss is your gain.
Ex-wife or mum?
Both. Lights. Ta-na! Music. Ta-na! Drink. I'm afraid I'm all out of coffee, which is good, because that means we can cut to the chase.
Who left who?
Ah. The great call centre of life, if only. Here.
Thanks.
I'll press one for the very posh and gorgeous totty in the psychology lectures.
Called?
Sophie.
Who didn't give you a second look.
Press two for the girl from Anglesey I met in Falaraki. Can't remember her name. And press three for Karen Williams in 5D. Oh, yeah.
And then press hash to go back a step and choose another option.
Or just tell them all to just sod off.
Have a heart attack and die.
You what? No, what did you say?
Nothing. Nothing. Being somebody
else.
Hi, beautiful.
Shit! Shit!
Bad dream.
What are you doing in my bed? This bed would...
Very bad dream.
What happened to Renata?
Renata? Wow, tell me more.
Renata!
Not that awful tranny down at Gaze. If you're dreaming about her, then you do need help.
Alf, tell me, what's that all about?
Well, that was a play. It's an example of what radio can do, in that I was playing a character with four personalities, with different accents. And you're not meant to know it's the same person till the end. It was written by a very good writer, Martin Jameson, and it was one of the first big leads I had for Radio Manchester. So it was all about a guy with multiple personalities. So there he's getting off with a woman in the nighttime, and then he's this gay character in the day, and then da-da-da-da. Quite near the knuckle. So, yeah, that's why I chose that.
So talking of versatility, I think we're going to hear you doing a German in The Iron Curtain.
Had you been to a socialist country before?
No.
Oh, a woman goes into a state office, asks for a telephone to be installed. Ah, that is no problem, the man says. The engineer can be with you in 15 years' time, on the 10th of May, 2001. Oh, the woman says, that is no good. I have the plumber booked on that day. Oh, tell me, have you seen the work of Henry Moore?
Some.
And?
I'm not sure I understand it.
Well, you must like art. Have you been to the galleries? The Royal Academy, the National Gallery, the Colosseum, the Opera House?
Have you been to London?
Well, they won't let me. Though I'm allowed to learn your language, I am reduced to reading about your culture in books. Do you read?
Yes, German and English.
Well, we should share libraries and see if there is a crossover in our worldview. We should challenge each other.
You like a challenge?
That is a statement. I didn't hear the question mark.
That is correct.
You intrigue me.
I'm 21.
Then I am double your age, exactly.
That was my first meeting with Canute. Dr. Canute Loeffler.
How was the trip?
Good. Really good.
And the lift back?
He was really fascinating. We talked all the way about the GDR. Books, art, music, history, everything.
Was he outspoken?
Very. I haven't heard anyone speak like that before. It was so refreshing.
I hope he's careful.
And you're very well travelled on the radio as well, aren't you, Alf?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the joys of it is you've got to remember that the radio is producing something like 280 new plays a year, which is more than all the theatres in the country put together. So it's a great avenue of new writing. And this series was a thing called Writing the Century, which was based on people's diaries. And this woman, Paula Kirby, she met this guy, Canute, in Germany, East Germany, and they fell in love and everything. Then the wall went up. It basically completely curtailed their relationship, and it was about him trying to get over the border to her, and he never actually made it. He actually died. It's an incredibly moving story, and the woman who wrote it wrote to me afterwards saying that she really liked the production, so it meant something to me. So that's why I included that. And I was also working, the girl in it was played by Charlotte Emerson, who's an old friend from theatre when I did play at the Royal Exchange, so it was lovely to work with her on that.
So how does one become a radio vocal artist? What would you say?
Yeah, I mean, it's changed. I mean, the good news is that there are far more opportunities than there were when you and I were coming out of drama school. Podcasts have absolutely exploded this last lockdown and in the last few years, that dramas are being done in a sort of YouTube basis, and people are getting together and making dramas and just putting them out there. The BBC no longer has a monopoly on it. If you want to join the BBC, you can still ask for an audition. It's in the BBC's charter that anyone who writes in has to be given an audition at some point. It might take years and years and years, but it is still part of their charter that it used to be anyone. I think they've now limited to people who've actually trained as actors. But at one stage, anyone could write in because it's a taxpayers' corporation. Anyone could be considered. And there are computer games. There are audio guides. There's dubbing for films. There's loads of opportunities now. You just need to make a proper showreel. There are now loads more voiceover agents than ever it used to be. Their sole purpose is to get you voice work. So it's not like just having a theatrical agent who might have someone in the office who deals with voice. There are dedicated voiceover agents. So for voice work, people aren't interested in what you've done. They're not interested if you've been at the National or if you've done a big telly. They're listening to your voice. And in this age of, you know, people are very hung up about race and looks and all the rest of it, it completely takes that away. It's about what you sound like. I had to do a vocal replacement for an actor who had a stroke and he couldn't complete his ADR on a production. So I did a test to try and sound like this man. Now, it doesn't matter what I look like, what my experience was, they are just going to pick the person who best sounds like that man. It's a real democratic process in that way, I think. The people aren't interested, especially in the commercial world, they're not interested in what you've done, it's what you're doing.
So, to give an idea now of the giddy heights, of just the quality, the good taste of radio drama, my dear friend Alfred, Mr. Keeble, doing something called Higher, with a subtitle, The Meal in China, which reminds me of the Derek and Clive tapes we used to listen to. Number six, The Meal in China.
Bravo! This is going very well. Now, the rice wine.
Take it easy, Jim.
This wine has been buried in a cesspit for 50 years. It is very strong.
How lovely. Good, come on.
Now, fill the horn like so, and you must drink it one go.
Oh, it's still got the stringy, sinewy bits in it.
There! Never let it be... Oh, God, it's room steady. Steady! I greet my new friends. I grasp the horn of friendship. I quaff the cess wine of blood brotherhood. I cherish the memory stick of entente and the scraper of old sores. Give me your short planks. Give me another horn. Give me two horns. Give me a cornucopia of horns.
That's tautology.
Oh, God, I think I'm going to explode. It's like magma in my gullet and pyrocastic flow in my lower bowel.
Some more eyelid with cheek hanging.
Oh, God, I really do have to find and use some facilities.
Very bad manners if you walk out of the feast.
My bowels are on fire.
And now I wish to embrace my friend, Pro-Pro-Pro-Pro-Gimmer. In sign of respect and agreement.
The dean of number 2 university.
Oh, God, don't say number 2. I heard him. Yes. There's a burning tsunami avalanching in my centre stomach.
He pays you great honour and wants to embrace you in a sign of friendship.
That could be risky.
Hug him.
Come here. Oh,
come. Oh, I'm guessing you took a wrong thing.
Oh, better out than in.
Now, sign here.
There.
Excellent.
Oh, see you later. Oh, thank you. 3 cubicles all free. There is a guard. Oh, no. Squat job with footprints. Got another. Oh, my God. My God.
What was the problem?
Behind the third door was a civilized pedestal.
That's good.
But the sorry blighters had used it as a broom cupboard, and the pedestal was stuffed full of mops and buckets, and the whole lot was cordoned off with tape like a crime scene.
Well, what did you do?
I'd rather not say.
Oh. Oh. Your turnips.
I fear it says a lot about me that that's my favourite clip.
Well, that was in series 4 of a thing called Hire, which was written by a guy called Steve May. And he only really used his real name in the last series. It was all about a hypothetical university. But he was a creative writing director at a university like this. And everything in it, in this particular clip, the Jim, who's the vice chancellor, the character I was playing, has gone over to China to recruit students. So all the things in it that seemed absolutely over the top and far-fetched were things that happened in the higher education sphere. And as I say, he was working in this university, so he had to write under his pseudonym, which was Joanne Bryant. Now, his name is Steve May, Bryant and May, but that last series he wrote under his own name. But yeah, it was great. We had people like Mark Heap in it and Sophie Thompson and people like that. And it was heightened comedy, and I just had such an absolute ball doing it.
What I'm just interested. You know, I mean, when I grew up, as you know, I grew up in Fiji, no television in Fiji. So my youth wasn't telly. It was Tony Hancock and Round the Horn and Goons. What were you listening to apart from Under Milk Wood?
Yeah, I listen to records, really, of things like that. I think we have to remember that a lot of our dramatists, a lot of the people that we revere now, people like Pinter and Tom Stoppard and Alan Ayckbourn, going back a bit, Beckett, all of these people, they grew up listening to radio. Radio was the media. TV didn't really exist in their youth. And often their plays, you will find that there are things in their plays that make a lot more sense when you take on board that those would have been the influences they had. Pinter, the pauses. There's nothing more dramatic and amazing on radio than silence. The wordplay in Tom Stoppard, he would have been influenced by radio plays, which were written mainly by poets in the early days. Dylan Thomas, Louis MacNeice, people like that. They were the ones who realized what radio drama could be. So it was really poets who started writing radio drama. And then the dramatists who picked up on it, it influenced all their work. And they all started on radio. Stoppard, Pinter, Orton, anyone you can think of from that era started writing on radio. And yeah, my influences were those. I would get records of things like Round the Horn, you know, going into that. One of my favorite jokes about Round the Horn was when Marty Feldman became a film star. He used to write Round the Horn, and he left writing it to go over to America. And the guy who took over, it was his first broadcast. And on the night the broadcast went out, he got a telegram from Marty Feldman saying, who needs luck when you've got talent? Good luck, Marty.
That I like that a lot. Oh, Marty Feldman, wonderful, wonderful.
I've used that in good luck cards quite a lot, actually. Yeah,
I like that. Moving on, because time is against us. I wish it wasn't. Isn't The World According to Garp one of your favourite novels, Alf?
Yeah, John Irving is one of my favourite novelists. He's very Dickensian in an American way. I grew up part of my youth in America, and yeah, it was the novel that broke John Irving as a major writer.
All right, then.
Prostitution is legal here.
Is $20 a lot of money for it?
No, that's pretty good. At least it's very low for the good-looking ones.
You know all about it. Sorry.
He just hit me.
Sorry. I just don't understand all this lust, lust, lust. I can feel a sentence boiling in me. I just don't, can't see it.
I could, though. The next night I went to see her. Her name was Charlotte, and she was not surprised to see me. She never told me how old she was. She had taken very fine care of herself. She had stretch marks on her belly and her breasts. She told me her child had died long ago.
One day, I will retire. I have a lot of money saved. I will move to Munich, where I know no one, and marry a doctor.
A doctor? Why?
He will take care of me until I die. What will you do with your life?
I want to be a writer.
Oh, a writer. You are too young.
I know.
What do you know about life?
Nothing.
So, what are you writing?
Trying to write a story.
That was Lee Ingleby playing Garp there, and Miranda Richardson playing his mother. I remember the first time I read John Irving being blown away, and I still get every book that comes out.
So we're going to move now to your very last choice. And I don't know what the hell's going on with this one. So introduce it for us, would you?
Okay. 2019, I was very privileged to be the chair of the UK International Radio Drama Festival, where we listened to a number of plays over a week and had to judge them. And this one just stood out for me because, like my first choice, it has an amazing central performance. The guy is called Gaspare Balsamo, and he's a Sicilian. And there's a tradition in Sicily of storytelling. And vocally, it's incredibly accomplished and operatic almost. I think the clip we're going to have is just the opening, but he doesn't hold anything back. And I love that. And out of the week, it was the one that I probably thought about the most. I mean, there's some wonderful dramas that week, but this one just stood out for me in its sheer audacity of performance.
And it's Torrent of Dreams, I believe.
That's correct. It was actually a German production. Germany do amazing radio dramas, and this was a German production, but it's this Sicilian actor called Gaspare Balsamo.
Let's have a taste.
Fera, 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 allontanati Fera, a Fera pisce bestino, a Fera e malupisce,
Afera e pisci infami, afera e pisci traditori, afera e malacanni e bastardo.
Marvellous, marvellous. Sadly, we're coming to the end. Now, as you know, we're going to let you have a piece of music to take with you. What have you chosen, mate?
I have chosen Katachurian's Adagio from Spartacus. The reason I have chosen this is, first, I grew up partly in Devon, and Dartmouth was very near me. And at the time when I was growing up, the Aeneiden Line was filmed in Dartmouth. And I do remember going down as a young lad and watching some of the filming and being quite entranced by the whole process. Also, the other reason, which might not make the cut, is that later on in life, I discovered that it was the perfect length to make love to. And the final wave crashing is serendipity itself.
So here we are, back in COVID times. Cheer us up, please, would you, mate, with a happy memory or a fun memory of you in lockdown?
Well, I grew up a lot of the time by the seaside, and one of the things I want to do is return to the seaside, and I get a bit old. And one of the questions about that was, how do I continue working and living in a beautiful place by the seaside? What this year has done for me is that, completely by chance, in February of last year, I set up my own studio in my home. I was getting requests from America to do audiobooks and various things. And so I set up this studio before lockdown, nothing to do with COVID. Because of the lockdown, I had to learn very quickly. So this year for me and the whole lockdown experience has been a learning experience of learning how to record, learning the technology, which when you get to a certain age, you know, can be quite daunting, but I'm much more confident now than I ever was. And so it has given me, going forward, an absolute confidence that I can earn my living anywhere in the world.
Yes. My darling chum and pal, it's been a delight chatting to you, and I'll see you soon for a pint sometime.
That would be lovely.
All right, matey. Thank you ever so much.
Cheers, my dear.
Thank you for joining us on COVID Island. Bye-bye.